Accession number 32299, Reel 1.
Tom Lees, Reel 1. Could you tell me where and when you were born, please?
I was born in Liverpool. Liverpool, and this was in the Sefton Park area of Liverpool. And I've got the... here. And... wait a minute. And I went to a school in Liverpool, a boys' school, a primary school first of all, where I won a scholarship to for secondary schools, and I went to a place called Quarry Bank High School, which was an independent day school, and I had a very good education there. Now, I was 13 years old when the war started. I was born in 1926. I was 13 years old, and the whole school was evacuated at the outbreak of the Second World War to a school in North Wales at Wrexham. And we went by train from Liverpool, a special train, and we all went to Wrexham. And that incident, I was seen off by my mother and father, and that was the last time I saw my father for some time, because he was called up for active service with the army, and that was that.
What did your father do for an occupation? What was your father's occupation?
He was in the shipping place. Liverpool was a tremendous world famous shipping place, and he'd been tied up in shipping all his life. Not in any great senior place, in a modest shop, you know. He was in charge of diplomatic clearances and that sort of thing. But he was a great guy, and I missed him very much. But I subsequently became the head of the family, as it were, to help my mother, because I had two brothers who were all younger than me and one sister. And we did, in actual fact, live an interesting life during the war years, as a family.
Were your sisters and brothers evacuated as well?
No, they weren't. I was the only one who was evacuated. They stayed at home. And we went to Wrexham, and I was lucky enough to be selected by a family who owned a great shop, an outfitters, people called Jackson. And it was a lovely house, and three of us went to live with them. We arrived at this house, and they had the sort of thing that was effective in those days. They had a maid who was properly dressed in the proper black and white uniforms, and she took charge of us. Three schoolboys, actually, showed us up to a small dormitory in the house with three beds, and we spent a lovely time there. We used to go to school in the mornings 1 week, and the Grove Park Grammar School boys would be working in the afternoon, and the following week we'd change over. So it worked absolutely fine. And but unfortunately, it didn't last long enough for me, because at the end of the before the bombing in Liverpool started, we stayed there about six or seven months, and then we were all we went back to Liverpool to resume our normal school activities, etc.
So you'd gone back what, in 1940?
In 1940, that's right, yes. And the bombing in Liverpool started in the winter of 1940, and when we headed to, they were attacking the German bombers were attacking the docks and all the communication experts, because Liverpool was the headquarters of the Western Command, I think, in those days. It was a very important military strategic target. And we used to watch the German bombers coming in and we'd dive into our air raid shelters and just stay there and keep our fingers crossed.
Was it quite exciting for a teenager, that sort of thing, rather than, or was it a worrying time?
It was certainly exciting, but it was not that you might call it exciting in the stage that you use the word exciting in these days, because it was really serious bloody stuff. And I had to, for instance, I had to, with my brother, my number two brother, I had to put the air raid shelter in. The first place we put in the garden was too far away from the house, we realised, so we had to dig it up again and then put it back in again. It was one of those Anderson air raid shelters, and I didn't like the design of it, so I thought I modified it. I'm always modifying things, but I modified it by moving two of the curved pieces of steel. It was made up of was it three or four pieces of steel this way, and a slab on each end, and you dug it into the ground. But that was too much, because anything, it didn't give you any protection from the front. So I took two of these steels off and put it over the front, and the whole thing was covered. I made it deeper, and the whole thing was covered in earth, and we grew grass on top of it. And you know what? The one day I remember, if it hadn't been for that pile of earth in the top and my modification, an explosion, a bomb dropped about, or must have been about 500-600 yards away. But one huge great stone, about 6 inches in across, came hurtling through the air and smashed into the front of that thing and buried itself in the ground. I mean, just, if they hadn't had that, it would have gone straight through the entrance and killed us all. So it gives you an idea. So it was exciting, but it was exciting in a way. And we used to go out and collect on the way to school, for instance, in the morning. It was very, very difficult because we sometimes arrived late, not just by a few minutes, but by hours, because the place was all bombed. And we spent a lot of time picking up caps of shrapnel and all that sort of thing. But and so the whole, and of course you couldn't really do any homework either at night time, or you could do it, but you had to be one ear open for the bloody sirens going when you obviously couldn't. You had to take refuge. But there we were. At any rate, that's my school days. Now I joined the Air Training Corps, and I was eventually promoted corporal in that, actually. But the great beauty of it was that because I joined the Air Training Corps, I then had some other friends, obviously at school, and somebody, and the news of the Battle of the Atlantic and the sinking of the Bismarck and all that sort of thing, it was really good news at that time, and everybody wanted to join the, well, quite a few of us. I was originally going to join the Air Force. I had a cousin who had been flying Spitfires, and he'd been killed in an accident. So I was in, that was what I was in joined for. But I changed my mind and thought, oh, the Navy is much more interesting. And so as soon as I was 16, I volunteered. I went down for an interview at Crewe. They had an Admiralty interview board down there. I was accepted for pilot training. And then I was able to wear a special thing showing that I was a Fleet Air Arm chap, being accepted on my uniform, which entitled me, when we used to go and visit RAF aerodromes, you could have free lifts in the various aeroplanes. And then my very first flight in an aeroplane was in a Whitley bomber. And we, five of us, went over this. It was on a test flight from one of the airfields over in the Cheshire. And I always remember that because the guy came right down low and he went hurtling up the River Dee with about 6 feet off the ground, and I was standing right behind him and my eyes were standing out. That gave me a real thing. I've done it many, many, many times since then, actually, at much higher speeds, but this old Whitley bomber really, really fixed me. And the next year, we went to a different place, and there was a small naval detachment there, and because I was a Fleet Air Arm candidate, as it were, they allowed me to go in the back seat of a Blackburn Skua, which is a dive bomber, a very early airplane, a dive seal airplane, actually, but I went in the back seat there. So that was that.
Yeah, given this interest in joining the air training, had you had an earlier interest in aviation?
Yeah, well, yes, I had, because I remember my father took my brother and me along to Alan Cobham's circus, which was visiting, and I remember going into a field with all these biplanes flying around. That was absolutely astonishing because, you know, it was the very early days of aviation, really, and they were giving flights. We didn't have enough money to actually get a flight. But nevertheless, just looking at the aeroplanes and landing and taking off and waving the general bonhomie, it was absolutely superb. But that was the first experience that I'd had of that. But where about, how far have we got? We got to...
You were with the Air Training Corps and you were a Fleet Air Arm.
Oh, that's right, yeah. Well, now, I'll just tell you why, but the other activity that went on in the school, but it is of interest to me at any rate, because during the school break, during the school holidays, when we were 16 years, no, before, 15 or 16, we used to go and help on the land with the farmers. The whole school decamped, and we went up to Lancaster and across into the West Riding of Yorkshire, and we were fed out to the various farmers to help them with the harvest. And I liked this. It was a great life. And a chap called Dick Atkinson had a place called Woodgill Farm, Keysdom, Yorkshire. It's still there. And I used to go not only on the official visits with the school, but I used to go at every school holiday I possibly could to go up there and visit them and help them. It was very, very lonely. It was a sheep farm, but it was a hill farm. But they had to, during those days, they were made to sow and grow things like turnips and carrots and cabbages as well, because the ground wasn't suited for it, and the product was pretty miserable, and a bit of corn. But generally speaking, the most important thing was the sheep. We used to go up on the fell, round them up, and get them back down again and look after them, and then we'd cut peat and for the fires, and we'd go down. And the best time when they first started off, it was to help them with the hay harvest in the June time, just immediately after the examinations had finished. Glorious hot weather, we'd be out in those fields very early, as soon as the sun was up and the ground had more or less dried out, and we'd spend all day doing the hay harvest. And we only had one horse and various odd things like that. For instance, in order to cut a field of hay, we had to, or corn rather, hay was easier because we could use the mower, still pulled round by the horse. But in order to clear the thing for the harvesting of the wheat, he had to scythe all round the edges to make room for the horse to go around, and pulling the scythe. And that was interesting. And then, of course, once the hay was all cut with the cutter, we'd have to go around with rakes by hand. And that was the job, because it used to wear out the thumb of your hand. Great big blisters would form. And doing that all day and turning the hay. Nowadays, you just drive up a tractor, and it's absolutely. We used to have fields in this field behind you here. We used to do our own bit of burn. It makes it easy with a tractor, but we didn't have any tractors. At any rate, I eventually, when I was old enough, I had my call-up papers. Do you want me to tell you about it? I was originally going to join in September, which was in the month I was born in August. I was going to join number 69 course, which is the course from in September. And everything was fine. But I received notification that the course was full or something, or they had some sort of a problem, and they wanted to delay my joining the Navy, and delay it until December. And I wrote back to the Admiralty, the Lordships, and I said that I really was most upset about this. I really wanted to join right away, if not sooner, than I could. I explained the different circumstances. And to my great pleasure, I received a reply back saying that I would be able to join in the August. So I actually joined when I was 17, and it wasn't, and that was that. And I went down to St. Vincent, which was great. My first time I'd been south of Cheshire, in actual fact. And we took the train. My mother saw me off, as mothers are wont to do, from Lime Street Station in Liverpool on the train, and we went down via London and down to Portsmouth and across on the Gosport Ferry to HMS St Vincent, where we started 3 months of pre-training.
Prior to that, had you had to attend some kind of selection board?
Oh yes, I'd had a selection board when I had joined the
Air Training Corps, and I was, as soon as I was 16, I applied to join the Fleet Air Arm, and I was selected. I was told to go to a selection board at Crewe. I don't know why it was Crewe, but there it was. And we travelled down to Crewe, and I was a number of us. And you know, they asked me various questions, sort of severe-looking naval, much more old naval officers, all sitting around a table. And I was successful, and I was selected for pilot training.
Did they do that right at that level for you? Did they? Was that at that point of the selection board? They said you will be a pilot at that stage.
Yes, we were asked various questions, and I think they judged us by our answers. And some people, I suppose they looked at some people and thought, well, you're more likely to be an observer, and so you're more likely to be a pilot, or I'm not quite sure what the thing was. But whatever system they used, I was selected as a pilot.
Were they interested in your background and your education, that sort of thing?
Oh, yes. And I remember them. They asked me what books I'd been reading and little odd things like that, and what qualifications I had, and I was able to tell them, give them all the right answers, and that was it. And I was very pleased to be selected.
And do they give you at that stage a medical as well to see that you're, you know, physically okay to be a pilot?
I can't remember that, but I wouldn't get at all surprised if they gave us a quick medical examination. I mean, see, I can well remember in those days I only weighed about 130 pounds or something or other, and I was lean as anything. Well, we all were in England. There weren't any tubby people out there. We were all on bloody rationing, actually, and I was as fit as anything. I never used to walk. I used to run everywhere. so there was no problem over the fitness. But that was it. But going back to St Vincent, we did 3 months, and it was an excellent place. I was the youngest person there on the course, so we had some rather old fellows who must have been about 24 or 25. I wasn't 18 when I was only 17 still when I walked through the gates. And
how easy was that being so young? How easy was it being so young? Was it difficult?
No, I just accepted they. I was only small, young. There was some big buggers there. You had to be a bit careful, but they were all decent. They were all decent fellows. And I used to go. The routine there in the morning time was: you get up and you go for a walk about 2 miles, running around Gosport or wherever it was. And of course, some of these old chaps who'd been served in the as sailors and whatnot for a few years, they were puffed out, smoking too much and drinking too much. I didn't smoke, I didn't drink. Oh, I smoked a little bit, that's true. I started smoking when I was about 7 years old. Not very many. My father's never knew about it. But, oh no, I was pretty fit, and so it was just a jog for me. But they were difficulty. At any rate, three months of that was... was great. We all passed out as leading seamen. We joined as ordinary seamen, and this was leading seamen. We wore the standard naval uniform with a white cap band instead of the usual HMS thing. It was a white cap band, which signified that we were sort of officer recruits, as it were, or potential officers. And we had to be very careful. For instance, we weren't allowed out of the base for the first 4 weeks to ensure that we didn't disgrace the Royal Navy. Royal Navy has been an excellent educational device with me all my life, because I've got a lot to thank them for. At any rate, eventually we passed out from there. And
could I ask what the pattern of training was while you were at Gosport? What was the types of things that you did in that 3 months?
Oh, yes, and indeed. Well, first of all, there were things like how to tie various types of knots. We had boats. We used to go out with small boats, pulling big cutters, you know, and we'd learn all about medical matters, and we were shown some horrific films But what happens to you if you go out with the wrong sort of woman? What sort of sores you can get on your own John Thomas and all the rest of it? It might put me off to tell you that much, because I'd never even seen a woman. We only had my younger sister was the only woman I'd seen apart from my mother. I went to a boys' school, and I wouldn't look at my sister. No, I was a boys' thing, but it was a put you off, and. That was the general thing, to fit you for the general life in the Navy. We had a lot about the histories. The people, the instructors there, a lot of them were straight back from the Mediterranean conflicts, and they used to tell us the most interesting and spelled stories about how they'd been in the cruisers, and they'd been fighting the Battle of Cape Matapan, and they'd been dive bombed by the German bombers in the Mediterranean, and all this sort of stuff, and how some of them had been killed. And it was really interesting stuff, and it really sort of fired you up. And of course, all you couldn't go anywhere without, every time you went out port, the Navy was held in great, great respect, as indeed was the Air Force and the Army, of course, in those days. Everybody pulled together. I don't think they pull together quite so much these days, but in those days, every single person was pulling in the right direction. And if you weren't pulling in the right direction, you were imprisoned. I mean, if you were a German or obviously if you were a German, but the people were in concentration camps and sort of
internment camps
they call them. That's right. Yes.
So, in this, am I right in thinking in this first stage of your training, it's really to induct you into naval life, isn't it?
That absolutely. You are part of the Royal Navy. To show you that you were joining a tremendously powerful naval force, a force, and to be a proud member of a very good organisation. And that's the way the Navy is, actually. It really is good. No nonsense about it.
And where were you accommodated at St Vincent?
In the barracks there. They're still around, actually. HMS St Vincent was being barracks. I think they were built in the Victorian times. And we were taught how to make your bed straight away. You know, issued with your own blankets. And how you'd get up in the morning, the very first thing you'd do would be to make your bed properly. And if you didn't have the sheet straight and almost flexible enough so the guy could drop a coin on it, would bounce up, almost, not quite there, you know, you were made to make your bed again. So no, all that was done and tidy, and had kit inspections and make sure that everything was in the right place, and it was a strict routine. I didn't mind that at all. That was absolutely fine. And everybody was doing the same. Some of the older fellows would grumble a bit, but it didn't affect me. I just naturally accustomed myself. I'm still that way now, much to my wife's annoyance sometimes.
Who showed you what to do?
Well, we had instructors there. There were a large number of people there at the same time. Some of them had just joined. Some of them were halfway doing the course, and the other ones. Well, there were 3 months' supply of courses there, and we worked our way up. So it one month, one whole heap of people would leave, and we get a new batch in, and we did the final march past. Was always done to the glorifying. They used to play the march past Wings Over the Navy, and we'd all be marching, and we'd swing round just like the Guards parade, or in our parade round. And there were, I must remember the chief instructor there was Chief Petty Officer Wilmot. Who you had forgotten him, and you could never understand what he was saying. He would stand up there and he'd say, "Ah, ah, ah," and you soon got to know what it meant. He was a brilliant man. Everybody respected Chief Petty Officer Wilmot. He's reputed to have got his DCM, I think it was, or something or other, by shooting down a Heinkel bomber or something or other from the rooftops with a machine gun. You've heard the story before. Ah, yes, Chief Petty Officer Wilmot, not to be forgotten.
I take it then as well that you, some of that time had been spent learning to drill?
In what?
Learning to drill.
Oh yes, we spent a lot of time on the parade ground, but backwards and forwards, attention and reverse and all the rest of it, most important. There we are.
Did you have to at that stage take the parade at all? Were you given?
No, that was always in charge of the actual instructors. And we were just the the people doing our best. But nobody wanted to fail. I didn't want to fail. You pull your finger out. You first thing in the morning, bingo, running, change. You had allowed so many minutes to get changed and into your proper uniform. Then you had to eat. Then you had on the parade. If you were out of order in any way, you'd be up on a charge. The only charge I ever had in the whole of my naval time, in actual fact, was once when I was halfway during the course, we were allowed to go and visit. I went back to Liverpool to visit my mother and see my brothers, just for a weekend. And coming back on the train, there was a hold-up. And the war was on. I don't know what the devil the whole was. The train was late. I was therefore late getting in. And I can still remember being up on Commander's report, actually, when he looked down at this poor, miserable chap, Naval Airman Second Class Tom Lees. And he said, you're late. What excuse do you have? And I told him about the train. He said, always remember, it's up to you. He said, you must allow for these things. And therefore, instead of waiting until the last possible minute or whatever it is, you must always go in plenty of time. Never be late again in the future. And he gave me 3 days, number 11 or something. 3 days confined to bat. I mean, I couldn't go ashore. Well, it was fine. And that's why nowadays I'm never late for going to an airport or anything else. I always get there in plenty of time. Again, my wife gets very annoyed sometimes. But
that's purely down to that early naval training, is it?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. It teaches you a lesson. Always be early. And I've always hated people who are. Well, late, leave things till the last minute. After I left the Navy, I ran an airline. Sierra Leone Airways. And I spent a lot of time abroad. I'll tell you about that as well if you wanted me to. But there, if anybody turned late, even when I was flying airplanes as a civilian, I would count down and I would go. And I wouldn't wait for anybody at all. And the very first trip I did when I went to Sierra Leone to begin with, we were flying a four-engine, small aircraft, four-engined. I'll remember the name in a minute. It took 18 passengers, and there was one German guy there, in actual fact, who was always late, and they'd always wait for him because he was an important chap. He was the boss of the Mercedes-Benz place, etc. And I was determined to go on time. I said, no, it's time now. He arrived about 10 minutes as I was taxiing out, waving his arms. I just carried straight on. He taught him a lesson, but after that, he was always on time as well, especially when I was flying the airplane. That's a side issue.